On this week's 51%, we meet a filmmaker whose mission is to raise awareness and instill compassion for all beings.
I do think my female side leads me to the stories and also helps me tell them in an extremely sensitive, compassionate way.
We hear about a program to get more female police officers into leadership, and we listen to an essay about toilet flowers. It's deeper than that. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'm not the man I used to be. So it all comes out in the wash. What would you see? Tattered pages in the ink stain, pockets of your jeans. So I've come to pay my respects at the wake. I've buried it all and I'm dancing on my own grave.
Emmy Award winner Alison Argo is known for her emotionally charged and deeply personal films, in particular her intimate portraits of abused and endangered animals. The award-winning films she's produced, directed, and written have all been broadcast by PBS and/or National Geographic and have reached audiences worldwide. The Last Pig continues Argo's mission to provide a voice for those who cannot speak for themselves and to deepen understanding and respect for all beings. The Last Pig recently screened at the Woodstock Film Festival in New York and is about a pig farmer in the capital region of the state. The film follows a pig farmer through his final year of slaughtering pigs as he comes to a life-changing decision. I asked her why she took on this subject and chose the farm she did.
Yeah, well, I've been making films for, I really hate to admit it, but it's almost 30 years. And what drives all of my films, or has driven all of my films, is my concern for non-human beings who can't speak up for themselves. And so my very first film was about gorillas in captivity. And when I met a gorilla named Ivan living in a shopping mall in Tacoma, Washington, he hadn't seen the sun for 30 years and hadn't met another gorilla for 30 years, I was just appalled, and I wanted to speak out for that individual. And since then, I've made a lot of films, and I've become more and more sensitive to the plight of other species and other individuals. And I've always been concerned. I mean, I've been a vegetarian for a long time because I can't make the films I make and then eat animals. So it's a personal choice that I've made. But I've always been really concerned about the livestock industry, especially factory farms. But I couldn't think of a way to tell a story that would be watchable, frankly. A lot of the graphic footage that comes out of undercover stories on factory farms are, I mean, pretty much unwatchable for a large portion of the world. And a friend sent me a link to a blog that this farmer, Bob Comas, had written. And I started reading the blog. It was entitled "Happy Pigs Make Happy Meat?" And by the time I finished reading this, I was absolutely in tears. It's like, this is the film I've been looking for.
She says he was reluctant at first, but it worked out. The film follows Comas at his now inline farm. It was Stony Brook Farm in Schoharie for his last year of pig farming through all four seasons. Argo says the intimacy of it being just her, cinematographer Joseph Brunette, Comas and the pigs, comes through on screen and is an important aspect to the film. And Argo says Comas was open about his suffering from anxiety and severe depression.
And in fact, when he agreed to let us make the film, he said, I'll let you make it only under the condition that you're willing to accept the risk that I may someday say I can't finish this because I'm in a deep depression. So miraculously, we got through the entire filming process. And shortly after he took the last pig to slaughter, he really went into a very dark place. And it just broke my heart. I wasn't able to contact him. I just had to back off. And I'd always felt like, oh, well, he'll always be there to, you know, if we need to pick up another scene or get some more voiceover or, you know, anything like that. But he wasn't. And I just needed to respect his boundaries. And he's since then sort of returned to he's regained his equilibrium, and so I'm looking forward to seeing him again soon. But that was a hard part of it, and I feel his pain when he's in that dark place. And there were times when we'd arrive at the farm and his wonderful old dog would kind of look at us like, it's not good. He's not in a good place. I'm so glad you guys are here. So I think, in fact, the film actually helped him because it allowed him to articulate a lot of what he was feeling. And I think that can help somebody work through conflict. And he was very, very open the entire time we filmed. And he loves the film, actually. I did send him a copy shortly after we finished, and he really appreciates it, and he's really grateful that his transition was told, and he's really hoping that it will inspire other farmers to make the transition, which isn't easy.
Argo offers a synopsis of her documentary.
The Last Pig is a very personal, very immersive journey into one man's life, a pig farmer, who after 10 years of raising pigs humanely, realizes that he really respects these individuals, and he does not want to take them to slaughter anymore. He just can't justify that any longer. And so during the course of the film, he makes the decision to stop, but he's got 250 pigs on the farm, and he can't find sanctuaries for him. So he's sort of trapped in this cycle that he started 10 years prior. So it's a very deep, contemplative film, and it's very personal. It's just this one person's story. And I think it's an opportunity for the viewer to go on this journey with Bob. The film asks nothing of the viewer. There's no narration. There are no facts thrown at you. There's nothing. You just go on this trip. And my hope is that by the end of the film, you start to ask yourself the same questions that Bob asked himself. These questions of who am I really? Where is my moral compass? What do I believe in? Am I living truly and fully, living up to what I believe in? And I know that through the course of making the film, I'm actually a better person because I had to ask those questions and, you know, sort of look at where is my life out of alignment? Am I the person who I want to be, who I really am, truly? And so I think it's a great exercise for anybody to go through.
You know, that's an amazing project then, when you can go through the process you just described of looking inward, reflection, et cetera, asking those tough questions of yourself. Did gender play a role in your ability to make this film?
You know, it's interesting because I was raised by a single mother, and I don't think gender, I think she just didn't pay any attention to gender. I'm sure she had struggles, but we were never focused on it. So I've just gone through my life without thinking about it. But I think absolutely the fact that I'm a female, and the fact that I also am extremely compassionate and empathetic. I mean, I'm an extremely empathetic person. I think that's largely why Bob said yes. We actually had to drive up there. It was my suggestion because he came very close to saying, no, I really don't think I want to be filmed. And I said, can I just come up and meet you? And you are under no obligation. And I'd also like to introduce you to the person who I think would be a great cinematographer. And he said, well, okay. So Joe drove 4.5 hours and I drove 4.5 hours and we all sat out there. And I think absolutely the fact that I'm a woman and the fact that Joe, and Bob said this, he said he doesn't generally like men very much because there's sort of a macho competitive edge. And Joe's an extremely quiet, sensitive guy. And so I think the fact that he has that personality as well really made a difference. But I think in all of my filmmaking, I do think my female side leads me to the stories and also helps me tell them in an extremely sensitive, compassionate way.
In the course of your filmmaking, and be it on the industry side or the subjects you're filming or interviewing, Have you found that gender, your gender, played a role in what was happening?
I do look back at my personal, you know, history in filmmaking, and it does surprise me that there really weren't women making films when I started. There were one or two, but they were sort of they were staff members at National Geographic. They weren't independent, especially in the wildlife the genre of documentary filmmaking. And there were couples, and usually it was the man was sort of the driving force, and everybody really focused on him. And the wife was always sort of the one a little bit more in the shadows who took the stills and recorded the sound. And I just have always made my films as an independent, and I'm looking back. I mean, there are more and more of us out there now, but it wasn't always so. I'm kind of a rare breed. If you look at my history, my early years are pretty rare. There was only one time there were two times where I felt my gender was a little bit of a disadvantage, and one was when I was interviewing a guy in England, and I could tell he was really irked by the fact that a woman was running the show, and I could tell I wasn't going to get a good interview. And so basically I asked my cameraman to conduct the interview. I basically gave him the questions and said, we're going to get a better interview if you ask the questions. And then the other two times were with gorillas, believe it or not. There was this gorilla named Ivan who lived in a shopping mall. He loved women. He loved me. He just fell in love with me, and he got so goofy and flirtatious that I had to leave the area so that he would ignore us and we could get some more natural behavior. And then the other time with a gorilla was and I've had this experience with chimps as well. Because I'm the woman on the set, and I'm clearly calling the shots, and I'm telling their caretakers, okay, go over there. No, sorry, can you walk in again? Okay, why don't you give them some food? Or, I'm clearly the person in charge. I'm the alpha, and there have been a couple of female chimps and gorillas who they're the alpha, and they, you know, started throwing things at me, because that was their role. And I was respectful of that because they live there. I can come and go. Sort of my gender stories.
I love your gender stories. I truly was not expecting them. You know, I wonder, gross generalization, when you talked about early on that there were few women out there doing what you were doing, I wonder with all the travel and all of that, if it wasn't because of, you know, being at home, if one is married or with kids. Again, gross generalization, but I wonder in the early days if that may have played a role.
I do have to say that I would never have made the films that I have made if I had kids. Had I had kids, I could never have made the films I've made. I just wouldn't have. I put in 80-hour weeks, like endlessly, and I wouldn't have been able to do that. So I made a choice, and I have no regrets, and I've got great nieces and nephews, but I couldn't have raised a family and have done this.
That was award-winning filmmaker Alison Argo speaking about her documentary, The Last Pig. Her films have won 6 Emmys and 100 awards internationally. You can find more information at thelastpig.com and argofilms.com. A majority of police departments in New York are commanded by men. As more women join the force, a week of training that took place in Saratoga Springs was to prepare female officers for leadership roles. 51%'s Lucas Willard has the story.
About 50 women from police departments across New York State and beyond came together at a week-long training session in Saratoga Springs that seeks to prepare female officers for leadership positions. The morning training session was being taught by Deborah Campbell, a retired colonel with the New York State Police. Campbell served as an officer for 32 years. She said when she started out, very few women held leadership roles. While that number has increased, Campbell wants to see more progress.
Women are still underrepresented, and I think that part of that is because women don't see themselves as a good fit for law enforcement, while they're an excellent fit for law enforcement. You know, men bring great skills, but so do women. Women bring great communication skills, great emotional intelligence, and especially today when the law enforcement profession is facing more scrutiny and sometimes criticism, I think that women and good leaders are part of the solution to the problem.
The program called the Women's Leadership Institute was developed by the International Association of Chiefs of Police and is sponsored by the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services. DCJS Executive Commissioner Mike Green said police agencies are losing out if they don't have diversity in their leadership positions.
Yeah, if you think about it, everyone in society has talent. And if we're limiting those leadership roles to a certain group, we're missing out on an awful lot of talent. And secondly, if you have diversity at the top levels of police departments, I believe you get much better decision-making because, you know, you have different points of view represented.
One of the officers attending was Sergeant Laura Emanation of the Saratoga Springs Police Department.
It is a great opportunity and a great privilege to be in the same room with people that have truly paved the way for other women in law enforcement and leaders in law enforcement, because the qualities that they bring to the table and the conversations that are had are very important and very realistic and very creative and outside of the box.
Some of the topics covered in the training sessions are the role of leadership, understanding individual differences, ethics, and recognizing and understanding implicit bias. Emanation said she will take away an important lesson about departmental power structures.
As I lead a distinct group of people, I also follow a very distinct group of people, and how to balance that and measure it and have it work hand in hand to benefit everybody involved.
The Women's Leadership Institute is one of several programs within DCJS's leadership training initiative. The state aims to train approximately 1,500 officers through next spring.
That was 51%'s Lucas Willard reporting. Embracing an historic change, the Boy Scouts of America announced in October plans to admit girls into the Cub Scouts starting next year and to establish a new program for older girls using the same curriculum as the Boy Scouts. Under the plan, Cub Scout dens, the smallest unit, will be single gender, either all boys or all girls. The larger Cub Scout packs will have the option to remain single gender or welcome both genders. The program for older girls is expected to start in 2019 and will enable girls to earn the coveted rank of Eagle Scout. The Boy Scouts Board of Directors, which approved the plan unanimously in a meeting at BSA headquarters in Texas, said the change was needed to provide more options for parents. The Girl Scouts of the USA criticized the initiative, saying it strained the century-old bond between the two organizations. Girl Scout officials have suggested the BSA's move was driven partly by financial problems and a need to boost revenue. We'll now hear from writer Dr. Jerry Burns, who offers a story about perspective.
This winter, we had some friends over for the first time. After giving them a little tour of the house, they stood near the kitchen door sipping their drinks. They gazed outside and their eyes rolled over the sandstone patio, the maple trees just beyond it, and the impressive woodsheds that my husband Barry built for our firewood. They could also see the copse of trees where my son and I used to play. We nicknamed it the Pine Cone Playhouse. We'd crawl in there under the branches, sit on the soft carpet of pine needles, and we made puppets out of the pine and fir cones. But our friends were more interested in something else that they saw outside the kitchen door. I think I see a bathtub and a toilet over there under the maple tree, one of them said in surprise. Like, why? Like, why not? We replied. And like everyone else who has commented on the wintertime kitchen view, they focused in on the toilet. I mean, toilets are, well, you know, gross. So we told them the toilet story. When Barry and I got married, we had a do-it-yourself backyard wedding. As performing artists in a new business, we had no money to spend, and we didn't want to ask our family to go into thousands of dollars of debt over a wedding, so we garage sale hopped all summer to buy 120 cloth napkins and 120 mismatched sets of silverware. We bought recycled paper plates. Firsthand, isn't that ironic, had a potluck wedding meal too. But we needed a way to keep drinks cold. We were anti-styrofoam and plastic on principle, but we also wanted to store the drinks in something with style, something with atmosphere. It was a wedding, after all. Then one day, on a garage sale hopping jaunt, we passed a clawfoot bathtub sitting on the side of the road next to a free sign. We dragged a friend back to that spot, and he helped us drag that tub home. During the wedding, we filled it with ice and cans and bottles. And after the wedding, we filled the tub with soil and planted impatiens. And we've done that every summer ever since. Our friends got impatient with the story around the impatience part. Figures. But Barry and Jerry, come on, a toilet? Did you have an outdoor toilet at your wedding, too? Nah, we had wedding porta-potties. Our indoor plumbing couldn't handle such a large party. Plus, we'd had chronic toilet trouble before the wedding and for many years after. So, when I walked out to my car one year on my birthday to discover a glistening white, brand spanking new low-flow toilet on the driveway, I thought it was the best birthday present ever. I quelled. I danced around that toilet on the driveway in plain view of every available neighbor. To make things even better, Barry installed it that day, and it worked like a charm. But now, we had a leftover toilet, which we couldn't flush down the new one. Instead of bringing it out to the curb, though, we decided to add it to the garden. I mean, it fit the bathroom theme. Great, our friends said, but really, it's kind of weird looking at a disgusting toilet. These friends were not the first to look askance at our garden decoration. Once again, our toilet was being judged. Because people tend to view them in only one capacity, toilets are assumed to serve only one purpose. But just like a clawfoot bathtub, toilets can be filled with flowers. And that's why it was in the garden. I was looking out at that garden recently this summer. I had been away for a while and noticed how our vegetable and flower gardens bloomed brilliantly since it had gotten sunny and warm. A colorful bounty of red flowers mushroom over the top of the garden toilet and spill over the edges. The bright red flowers and rich green leaves offer a breathtaking contrast to the sparkling white porcelain bowl below. But this year, I am impressed with the view for another reason. The stark contrast demonstrates the toilet's transformation from a thing of disgust to a thing of loveliness. It reminds me that toilets are not the only things in this world that appear one way on the surface, but carry the capacity for great growth and beauty. I try to look at it a lot now, during this time of political change, when, for good or ill, people are quick to judge and react to what they see on the surface. I look at my garden toilet to remind me not to judge, but to look for the beauty and potential that lies under the surface of people and of life itself. So, if you ever come to our house, you will get to see the bathroom fixtures in our garden. In summer, flowers fill them, and the rest of the year, they are bare of flowers. But now that you know the story, you know that they are far from bare. One other thing, if you come to our house and happen to have a bathroom sink sitting around gathering dust, bring it on by. We'd be happy to take it off your hands.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1474.